Sarva Shastra Dipiyusha Sarva Vedaika Satpala Sarva Siddhanta Ramnadya Sarva Lokaika Drikpada Sarva Bhagavata Prada Srimad Bhagavata Prabhu Paridvanto Ditaditya Shri Krishna Parivartita Paramananda Vataya Prema Varshat Shadayati Sarvada Sarva Sevyaya Shri Krishnaya Namostume Marika Bandhu Mat Sanghin Mad Guru Mad Mahadana Mad Nistadaka Mad Bhagya Mad Ananda Namostute Asadu Saduta Dayin Atini Cho Chata Kara Ama Muncha Kara Chinma Premanarit Kanta Yogspura O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Text number 23. Nishavasana Arabdo
Nishavasana Arabdo
Loka Kalpo Nuvartate
Loka Kalpo Nuvartate
Yavadinam Bhagavato
Yavadinam Bhagavato
Manun Bunjams Chatur Dusha Dasha
Manun Bunjams Chatur Dusha
Nishavasana Arabdo
Nishavasana Arabdo
Loka Kalpo Nuvartate
Loka Kalpo Nuvartate
Yavadinam Bhagavato
Yavadinam Bhagavato
Manun Bunjams Chatur Dasha
Manun Bunjams Chatur Dasha
Night Avasani. Termination. Arabdaha. Beginning from. Loka Kalpaha.
Further creation of the three worlds.
Anuvartate.
Follows.
Yavat.
Until.
Dinam,
the daytime.
Bhagavataha, of the Lord Brahma. Manun,
the Manus.
Bunjan,
existing through.
Chaturdusha,
14.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. After the end of Brahma's night, the creation of the three worlds begins again, in the daytime of Brahma, and they continue to exist throughout the life durations of 14 consecutive manus, or fathers of mankind. Purport, at the end of the life of each manu, there are shorter dissolutions also. So there is very frequent destruction of at least major parts of the universe. And every time that happens, what was destroyed has to be reconstructed. We see in the course of what we know as history, that wars, famines, destroy cities and whole nations, whole populations are decimated. Hare Krishna, frequently in this world, we've seen it in our own century, and at other times. In the Middle Ages, they had the bubonic plague, which killed, I don't know, two-thirds of the population of Europe. Maybe the buildings weren't destroyed, but the people were dead, and that required major reconstruction. These things are going on. That's this process of annihilation is not only something that only happens at the end of Brahma's day. It's something that, in varying degrees, is occurring constantly. There's constant annihilation. Lord Shiva is in charge of seeing that happens. Everything is constantly subject to corruption and destruction. But these are the major destructions. We have not seen major destruction, even though we may have read in our history books about what happened at the end of 1945, how Europe was just decimated, how atomic bombs were dropped on Japan. But we haven't seen, we only know, again, from books, but this is a book about much older history, much more distant history, about how the whole universe gets destroyed, or the three lower planetary systems. So what kind of reconstruction job Brahma has to deal with? How much difficult it is for him and the other Prajapatis to do their job, to reestablish order where there's chaos. We find it difficult to organize anything in this world, to make order out of chaos, even on a very small scale, just to organize a business or get our family finances together, you know, just to do a small thing. And the small matter of what we call creation, or let's call reorganization. It's not creation. Creation means to produce something that wasn't there before. But this is more of a cleanup job. Something was there before, but it's all been knocked down and made a mess out of, and it has to be reconstructed. So renovation work is rather what Brahma does most of the time. And what most creators in the world are just recreating. What was in order has been messed up, and it has to be put back together again. That takes the strength of the motive passion. One must be pushed by Rajoguna in order to do this kind of renovation work, in order to move the material energy about and produce order out of chaos. If we don't have any passion, then we're not going to be, we can think about it, but we're not going to do anything. We can make very nice, we can dream very nicely and make very nice plans, but as far as actually getting anything done, without the mode of passion, we can't. So therefore, Brahma, who has to do this major construction work periodically, every day he gets up, you know, it's like never finished. Every morning he has to do the same thing again, create the universe all over again, every morning. So he's strongly influenced by the mode of passion to make it possible for him to do his work. So where does that leave the Brahmins? Now, they don't have much passion. They may have some fire in their intelligence, in their brains, but as far as intelligence to do construction work in the material universe, to move the material energy around, they don't have it. And they're not supposed to have it. The Kshatriyas can manage, can rule, and the Vaishyas can do the productive work with the help of the Shudras. Brahmins are meant to give intelligent and spiritual guidance. This is a division of labor. There are those who are working in the mode of ignorance, those who are working in the mode of passion, mixed passion and ignorance, which is the Vaishyas, and then those who are supposed to be working in the mode of goodness. They're the Brahmins, although the Brahmins, you know, looking at the Brahmins nowadays, you would never tell that they're supposed to be working in the mode of goodness. But they are. That's the natural karma of the Brahmanas. What is it? Shamo Dhamo. This is the work of the Brahmins. Now, some think that a Brahmin doesn't have to do anything.
to sit around, smoke his hookah, and beg for some 10 rupees from somebody. Yeah, but that's, it's not the bits of a Brahmin. To eat, sleep, and do nothing. Or maybe sometimes stick your nose in a book. No. Brahmin has his activities, but these are activities in the mode of goodness. Shama damap tapap shau cham. Kshantir arjavmevaja. Gyanam vijnanam astikyam brahma karma svabhavajam. Hare Krishna, thank you very much. He's got to control his senses, his mind, and his senses. So this is defense work. Just like big country has so much assets, and 60% of those assets are invested in national defense, in developing the military against potential attacks of enemies, or just to have a lot of strength so that no enemy would even dare to try to attack. Out of the mouth. Don't put my 15 rupee pen in your mouth. So also the Brahmin has to invest his first attention into defense against Maya. The lower modes are around, the attractions of sense gratification are around, envy, hatred, greed, these influences are around. He has to protect his mind and his senses. First of all, shamaha. Try to keep your mind under control. If your mind is peaceful, if you're not thinking about sense gratification, if you're not thinking about who's your friend and who's your enemy, if you're satisfied, if your mind is satisfied, out of the mouth, if your mind is satisfied, then your senses are not going to give you a problem. You know, it's because it's when the mind is dissatisfied and disturbed, then the senses get their chance to disturb us. So first is shama. If you're successful, if you're good at shama, you don't have to worry much about dhamma. Dhamma means to beat the sense. Dhamma like to subdue somebody. Yeah, you can pacify somebody. Shama is pacification. You know, but you tell somebody, please don't do this. You know, don't disturb me like this. And then finally, he doesn't listen. You have to take a stick and hit him on the head. That's dhamma. You know, he won't listen. He won't be pacified. So you have to just subdue him. So the senses have to be subdued if the mind can't be peaceful, kept peaceful enough. It's like the military work of defending a city. You may have two lines of defense. If you know, one 200 yards away from the city, and then the second one at the city wall. If you have a perimeter of defense some distance from the city, but if the enemy breaks through that, then you have your second line of defense closer to the city, at the city wall, say. Like that, Dhamma is a Brahmin's first line of defense, and when the enemy of Maya breaks through that first line of defense, then he has to take up, you know, retreat to the second line of defense and struggle with his senses. Then he's got to worry about all sorts of rules and regulations. You know, my senses are my enemies, and I got to, you know, not let them do this and that. I got to, you know, keep them under strict discipline. You know, I have to, you know, pick up my cup with this hand, and, you know, and snap my fingers like this, and then say that mantra. Otherwise, I go to hell. So the karmakanda brahmanas whose minds are agitated, because they're full of envy, greed. They're supposed to be brahmins, but they're full of envy, greed, and lust. So what can they do? All they can do is externally practice control of the senses by following so many karmakanda rituals, because they're faithless. They're atheists. Therefore, their minds, no question of their minds being peaceful. So these lower class Brahmins, the ones who can't have a peaceful mind because they can't have devotion to the Supreme Lord, they have to follow the karmakanda rituals to win the battle of Dhamma. To keep their senses under control, they have to obey so many ritualistic stipulations. Just like the citizens are unruly, you got to be heavy with them. You have to have a dictatorship because the people are otherwise unmanageable. They don't listen to reason. If you just tell them what's right and what's wrong, they don't listen to you. So you have to impose military order, dictatorship. So Dhamma is the dictatorship over the senses, when they cannot be kept in a peaceful condition just by mind control, by subduing, by pacifying your mind. Those are the two. And that's just two. So the Brahmins get pretty busy without dealing with the practical world. Just inside his own head and his own body, he's got Shama and Dhamma to deal with. And then Tapaha. Okay, now moving outward from your mind, what do you do with the rest of your body? Practice austerities. Live in a simple place. Don't accumulate too much. Don't make your life too complicated. Don't take more luxuries than you need, that are going to make your senses addicted and accustomed to more than they need. The senses then become complacent and always demanding gratification. But if you don't gratify the senses more than is necessary, when you keep your life simple, that's a life of tapas, or austerity. That's the third business of a Brahmin. Tapas doesn't necessarily mean torturing yourself, but it means living a simple life and not taking more than necessary. That's hard work. Shaucham, keeping clean, is hard work. Keeping clean internally and externally by taking bath and not touching but dirty things. Not associating with contaminated people more than necessary. This is shaucham. And an internal cleanliness by chanting the names of God, by other use of transcendental sound vibration to keep the mind clean. And that's cleanliness. Tapak shaucham shantir. And here's the hardest thing to do. Forgiveness. To be ready to forgive someone who's hurt you. Okay, you did such a stinking thing to me, but I have to try to forgive you. That is an extremely difficult job of the Brahmins. These are the activity, the work you have to do in the mode of goodness. To be able to forgive someone who's abused you. Shantir. Or shantir can just be translated as tolerance. But the real sign of tolerance is you can forgive. Arjavam. Simple honesty. You don't say things that aren't true. You're not crooked. You don't deceive people. Try doing that. Try never speaking a lie. Ever. In the modern world, even when it comes time to pay your taxes. See if you can do it. That's what it means to be a Brahmin, is not speak lies. Gyanam Vijnanam Astikam. And then, at the bottom of the list, not the top, if you do all these other things, then we can talk about knowledge and realization and faith in God. First of all, do the basic things, and we can talk about the higher functions of a Brahmin. These are the higher functions, Gyanam and Gyanam Astikam. But unless you can be brahminical, unless you can have a controlled mind, controlled senses, unless you can be honest, then what's the use of giving you knowledge? What are you going to do with it if you're dishonest? If you can't control your senses? If you're full of envy, lust, and greed, and you say you're going to do something and you don't, or you don't say what you're going to do, then why trust you with knowledge? And you may even acquire some knowledge. You may fill your head with information, by hook or crook. You may just grab the books and study them on your own, even though nobody wants to teach you. But what realization will you get? If you want to get realization, vijnana, a student must get the blessings of his teachers. Just cramming the books will not give realization. The blessings may seem intangible and therefore not worth anything. But that's the key. By the pleasure of the teacher, the student gets realization. We can see examples of that so many times in Vedic history. The guru gives his blessings and therefore the knowledge becomes fruitful. And then last, astikam, faith. Astikam means believing it's real. So we commonly understand that to mean theism, believing that, that God is real. But it also means faith in the authority of the Vedas. That's actually the standard definition. Believing that the Vedas are authority. So these are the businesses of a Brahmin. They are functions of the mode of goodness. I switched topics, but it's a matter of, you know, it's an interesting comparison. It's hard work to use the mode of passion to create things. But it's harder work to use the mode of goodness to not get involved in that passionate business. To rise above passion is much harder. And then one becomes a Brahmin. Then he deserves, you know, some respect. But really doing it is not easy. Okay, so I can stop there. Any questions or comments?
It's, you know, I was reading in some letters, Prabhupada said, specifically of Boston, where he made the comment that you know, he noted that there were many colleges and universities there, and he said we should train, we should recruit the young boys and girls from those universities and train them up to be Brahmins and, yes, and preachers. You know? Yeah. So it seems like there's a burden on us to train up Brahmins. You know? And I guess where I'm going with this question is sometimes, like even myself, if I sort of think about myself, and I try to cultivate a Brahminical sort of, you know, lifestyle, or you know, try to be in the mode of goodness. But at the same time, just sort of there's certain practical things in the modern day that I have to sort of, like, for example, if I have a family, I have a wife, then I have to engage in something, even if it's a little bit on the side, but I have to do something to sort of maintain myself, you know, and that seems immediately sort of like a passionate activity. I can see how it affects me in a certain way, you know, because you have to deal with certain things in order to make money or something, you know what I'm saying? Well, so I'm trying to understand how, is that like, should even that has to be like...
Well, you should try to arrange your life so you can't live like a bum. Mm. That requires some groundwork. Okay, you got to get married. Better to marry because you're already married. That's hard. Yeah, I don't know your wife. So, but you should try to marry your wife. If you want to be Brahminical, then marry a wife who has Brahminical qualities also. Mm-hmm. You know, there should be a compatibility. If a man who's trying to be in the mode of goodness marries a woman in the mode of passion, then there's, you know, there's incompatibility there. Mm-hmm. It'll be difficult. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. You know, if you're going to get involved in that, then try to find an occupation that's Brahminical. Mm. I don't know in the United States what you can find. Well, you program computers or something. I did that. You sit there and hit a couple of keys and, you know, wait for the program to compile and chat around. You know, so it's sort of Brahminical. You know. Yeah, you just fiddle around a little bit. Nobody bothers you. So there are jobs that are more or less Brahminical. At least jobs where nobody bothers you much. Mm. You try to find a Brahminical occupation, a somewhat Brahminical occupation that lets you remain in the mode of goodness.
Mm. It seems like even that... Like,
and then be satisfied with the simple life as you can tolerate, because the more you need, the more you're going to have to hustle to get it.
It seems like almost any activity to make money is sort of contaminated by the mode of passion. And it seems like...
Yeah, so the ideal is just do your Brahminical service and depend on charity. If you can do that. Yeah, then that's what sort of, you know, how a Brahmin should live. Not even try to make any money.
Right.
So you know about Srivastava. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked him, how do you support your family? You know, you have four brothers, and you have children and wives. And not only that, you have a lot of servants. You have a big household here. You're all living together, and you're the head of the household. And you don't have a job. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was asking him, how do you do this? How do you maintain everything? What's your secret? And Srinivas Thakur just clapped his hands three times. I said, what is that? That's your formula? He said, yes. You know, how I take care of everything is That means if we don't get any food for 3 days, I'll just jump into the Ganges and drown myself. He just, he's refusing to do anything to make money. He's depending on Krishna. Yeah, he's got a big family, and Krishna and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was amazed by it, but he sees that everything's being taken care of very nicely. So a Brahmin who is fixed in the mode of goodness can get away with that. He can get away with not having to work to get money. Krishna provides, he does. But that's if you're actually in the mode of goodness.
In the garden.
Yeah.
He just sat there.
And he started off from low modes.
Really?
But he was transformed, and he actually just chanted. Yeah. And he said, well, where am I going to get my food? All I know how to do is kill animals. So you're telling me, throw away my bow, don't kill any more animals. I'll starve to death. Is that what I'm supposed to do? And Narada Muni said, I promise you, your food will come. And he trusted Narada. Maybe Narada didn't know how it was going to work. But he gave a promise, and Krishna arranged that Narada's promise was fulfilled.
And the neighbors were so impressed by his transformation that they just spontaneously kept bringing him.
So when Narada came, he saw the house was full of food. He said, where are you getting the food? I mean, I gave you the promise, but I didn't know how it was going to be fulfilled. Narada was amazed to see how it worked. He had so much food coming in. He told Narada, could you tone it down a bit? I'm getting too much food. Can you arrange it so I don't get so much? We have to give this away. We can't give it all away. So he asked Narada, maybe he gave, the blessing was too heavy. Just too much food is coming. And he was satisfied with that. He didn't need to go out and buy a television set or get a new car every year. So he got what he needed to eat, and he was living in a peaceful place. He was satisfied. And he wasn't even a Brahmin, but he was raised to the transcendental consciousness by Narada. So if you're supposed to be living as a Brahmin, then try to arrange your life in such a way that things are kept simple and you can be satisfied without... You may have to work. If you're going to live in the Western world, you're probably going to have to work. Even in India. Come live in India and you have to go home 2 months a year to go work. Unless you're in some special situation. It'd be very nice if we could arrange to support the Brahmins. But someone's going to have to come up with some money for that. A lot of it. And then we can start supporting a few free Brahmins, but it's not going to be easy. Yes?
I have one thing, and now this Prahlad, he got grown up, he was touring with sage, and he came across what is it called, the python man, the Ajagara, what is it?
Ajagara.
Ajagara. Now, is the python man story, is that just a very graphic, you might say rather exaggerated example of the same thing we're talking about, just depending and letting food come by Krishna's mercy?
It's an extreme case. Only a very rare soul can do that.
So you just lie down. You didn't even walk.
So a few yogis do that. The rare yogi who doesn't even beg, doesn't even go to where they're giving out free food. He just lies down in one place. Sits in one place, maybe he sits. Doesn't have to lay on his belly, but at least he just doesn't go anywhere. Makes no attempt even to get food for himself, and just takes a vow that food will come. I'll live. Food doesn't come, I'll die. Yeah, but that's only very advanced yogis can try that.
My other question was in Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada does say as a confirmation that Lord Vishnu is the supreme, he gives the example of such guna avatars as Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, who were controlled by the modes of passion, and not controlled but influenced, as you said in the class, by the modes of passion ignorance. To me it's a little hard to understand where someone, your guna avatar, you're actually in charge of a whole mode of material nature, and put it sort of like an occupational hazard. I mean, do you get It's hard to imagine Lord Brahma being influenced by the mode of fashion in the same way that, for instance, I would be influenced by him, because he's a guna avatar. So how does that work?
Well, to be an avatar, to be a guna avatar, to be a jiva empowered to be an avatar, you have to be given special empowerment by the Supreme Lord. And that includes special protection. So that's what Brahma was praying about back in chapter 9. Protect me, you know, that I don't get influenced by this mode of passion, at least not to the extent that I could start getting puffed up and thinking I'm the creator. So it's by the Lord's special protection that the empowered incarnation, that's why it's called Shakti Avesh, doesn't get too much influence, maybe a little bit.
And Lord Shiva also, he just externally, that he has these, you might say, ornaments of the mode of ignorance, but actually he's internally, he's Shuddha Sattva.
Yes, because he's not a jiva. So he doesn't have the potential to fall down that a jiva does. Whatever he does is according to his constitution. It's not conditioned. If he seems to be in a mode of goodness, it just seems. In a material mode of ignorance, that's just what it seems. He's not actually influenced like a jiva can be influenced.
Yeah, Obiel Kapoor calls him a jiva, and I underlined that and I put a question mark, and he said, no, it's not what we learned. That Lord Shiva, maybe under rare circumstances.
Yeah, Prabhupada never says that, but I have seen it in other Vaishnava descriptions. Considering, actually, even something from Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about Brahma and Jiva and Shiva as jivas. I don't know exactly how to answer that. Maybe it's just using the word jiva in a different sense.
Well, Brahma is very clear that sometimes when there's a lack of a qualified, jiva, then Vishnu himself becomes Lord Brahma.
So there's some variation. Yeah. So it may be that in some creations there's a Lord Shiva who's a jiva sometimes. Yeah, that the original Shiva sort of says, I'll pass on this universe. You know, they pick some deputy to do it for him. Maybe sometimes some universes there is a jiva who's Lord Shiva. So maybe sometimes he's a jiva like that because he's just a representative of the real Lord Shiva.
But the bottom line is that Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, they were each in their own respective ontological categories, and they're both guna avatar. But at the same time, in a certain sense, we have to accept that they actually do become, in a certain way, influenced by the modes that they're the avatars of.
To some small extent, but they're protected from any dangerous influence. And again, their situations are all different. Vishnu's different, he's Vishnu, he's God. Brahma is a jiva, and Shiva is something in between. So all three of them are different. So the potential they have, the danger, the potential danger is different for all three. For Vishnu, no danger at all. For Shiva, just whatever, you know, by his nature, he may get angry. And Brahma, he's a jiva, so he's potentially, theoretically, in danger. But he's protected. You know, when you take the job of being a Shaktivesh avatar, you get protection along with it. It's like, you know, if you take government service, they provide you a bodyguard and, you know, like that.
Yeah, so just a real quick comment that when you were talking about the necessity to be somewhat passionate in order to actually really execute things, you know, get things done. Here in the construction of the palace of the Bhaktivedanta Ashram, they had to bring in kind of a somewhat passionate American, or at least who had access to that mode, in order to really get things moving. I don't want to say too much detail, you know, but it's a very, very practical example that, you know, that there was the Brahmin was here, and he, as you say, you know, it just has so much of a practical reflection of what you were saying.
So Brahmins do depend on the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas, especially the Kshatriyas. If the Brahmins don't have support from the Kshatriyas, then they can't do anything practical. They can save themselves, go back to Godhead, But as far as accomplishing anything in the real world, they can't do it. You know, even educational projects, you know, they need the support of Kshatriyas to do it, and Vaishyas.
You like the discussion with Svayambhuva Manu and Vardhama Muni, was it?
Yes.
The two of them were glorifying each other's varna as the interdependence.
Yeah, interdependence between the Brahmins and Kshatriyas is the basis of human civilization. And if we have a situation where they're inimical to one another, the intellectuals and the government, where the government tries to obliterate the intellectuals, or the intellectuals are anarchists and spit on the government, then you have chaos. You can't have an orderly human civilization, anything that's really human and really civilized, unless you have Brahmins and Kshatriyas. First of all, have some, and then they have to work together. First thing is to have some Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Develop some. The development in such a way... Anyway, you can't functionally be a Brahmin or functionally be a Kshatriya without understanding the need to cooperate. A Kshatriya who doesn't respect the Brahmins is no Kshatriya. And a Brahmin who doesn't care for the Kshatriya is just a hermit. He can go off to the forest of the Himalayas, but he's not much use in human society.
Is it possible to make a parallel in the very famous example Jivan Mukta was just mentioning it yesterday between the lame man and the blind man, the idea of combining American strengths with Indian strengths, that somehow it is somewhat of a very large equivalence to this idea of Brahminical and Kshatriya cooperation?
Yeah. But, you know, it does require separating out the occupational duties. If the same person tries to do both, then you also get a mess. It also doesn't work. Now, you should have separate occupations. Somebody may be potentially capable of being both, but you can't function well. You know, you can ride a bike in 15 different gears, but you have to, going up a hill, you have to decide on one gear and ride that gear. So you may be able to be a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, if you're like that. But you have to pick one or the other. You should. Otherwise, it leads to frustration.
Well, how does the example of the lame man and the blind man...
the lame man should be satisfied to be the lame man and not try to be... and let the blind man help him. Not try to fulfill... You know, he's too proud that he can't admit his own limitation.
So they work together, but they don't merge.
Yeah, well, the blind man doesn't have eyes, so he can't pretend to have eyes. He's got, you know, if he just can't admit to anybody that he's blind, and ask somebody who has eyes to help him, then she's stuck. Hare Krishna. Oh. Okay, stop it.
We hear examples of sort of this interdependency between Kshatriyas and Brahmanas, and it's always in the manner of running a kingdom or, you know, some sort of these very grand scale. But I was wondering if you've thought about how it could sort of the same principles be applied, say, in running a temple or, you know, something practical. Or does it have to be like that? I mean, could just a Brahmin do it, or just a Kshatriya, you know, and like...
A spiritual community... See, what we've done in ISKCON is what we've done. You know, because we only had, you know, limited resources, human resources. And so I don't mean to criticize what's been done, but looking toward a more rational situation in the future... The jobs should be separated. A temple needs, a spiritual community needs Brahmanas, first of all. It's a spiritual community. So you need your preachers and teachers. Otherwise, what kind of spiritual community is it? And they're the leaders of the community. And then you need your managers. And ideally, the manager should be a manager and the teachers should be teachers. You know? If... the manager is also the teacher. He's not going to do such a great job of either. Not that the temple president, who's a manager, is a businessman, can't give a class. But there's somebody else who's more trained up how to teach and how to preach. And there's just specialists. Everybody can give class, but there are specialists in the Shastra. And they show how to preach, and others can also preach. Like that. So, in a better ISKCON of the future, there should be a class of Brahmins who do the Brahminical work and a class of administrators who do the administrative work. And it's not that the same person tries to be a Vaishya, to be the business manager, the human resource manager, to take care of the devotees, which is really the business of a Kshatriya, to protect the citizens, and also be the guru. All three in one. It's not a ideal situation. Let the guru just be a guru. Let the manager mostly be a manager. And let the, what's the third one? The businessman be a businessman.
Preacher.
Yeah, well, preacher is a Brahmin. Yeah. Let the Brahmins be Brahmins. Let the Kshatriyas be Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas be Vaishyas, and don't mix them up. Yeah. Everyone there could be overlapping. There are common activities. Every devotee should do some preaching according to his capacity. And devotees, as Vaishnavas, we don't just, say, well, I'm a Brahmin, I can't get my hands dirty. You do what's necessary. The Brahmin can also take out the garbage if there's nobody else to do it.
In this kind of sense, I'm sorry, I'm out of order.
No.
You have, it would seem almost like, even in a small temple, you have to have a temple president and a vice president. Or a temple president and a strong temple commander. Or say temple president and vice president, and then one could take the more Brahminical role and one could take the more management role. Because temple president is management position, but at the same time he has to be sadhu, he has to teach, he has to show Brahminical strength. Same problem is there with I feel sorry for the GBC because they're being criticized for not being managers. But they're supposed to be the Brahminical head of the society. Their job was supposed to be to see that the temples are clean, that devotees are chanting their rounds, and not managing like in the sense of a manager, but managing just in the sense of a Brahmin who just oversees and tries to inspire people with his own example. And now they're being called to task for failures which should have been averted by the actual managers, the more hands-on, maybe the temple president. So that's, I'm not saying that there's no fault at all, but it seems like just the definitions were never really, job descriptions were never really...
Job descriptions were never defined, and training systems have not been developed. We have, certainly, we may think we have some sort of, we got a gurukul. We don't have proper training systems because we've never even defined the jobs. How are we training people for these jobs when we can't even figure out what the jobs are? So that's what has to be done. Define the occupational duties and develop training systems for them. Especially for Brahmin Kshatriya. Vaishyas can learn, from the available educational resources. Shudras just learn some practical skills. But we don't have in the world educational systems for Brahmins and Kshatriyas. That has to be created.
When Srila Prabhupada was physically on the planet, it was a sort of a default mode that there was such a strong concentration of absolute authority in Srila Prabhupada that it just, without having too much practical training or qualification, there was respect, and somehow people followed, even if you perhaps were making a mistake, but because of the strong engine of respect for authority that was there because of the founder Charya being there physically. So as you say, it's quite correct that now it's been 20 something years and we have to humbly do very, very practical, something maybe it may not seem like may not seem ecstatic, you know, at the outset. What we have to do is very practical work that you're saying.
Yeah, it's not easy. Not easy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Okay, so stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.